even their rights have been confiscated. But when it is personal, mm-hmm. for the rights of the person and the individual of Ahlul Bayt or the family right, they do not ask for that, even if that right has been usurped from the noble progeny of noble prophet.
So basically, we cannot expect even Imam Ali alayhi salam to ask it, because as you said, that Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said that if it is even their right and it is proven that it is their right, they will not follow it again.
When it is personal, of course, for the person of Ahlul Bayt and the
when it's personal, yes. I mean, it's not it's not related to the right of public. It's related to their own rights. Yeah, that's a good answer for this. We naturally can expect such a thing from the leader of the Islamic Ummah, that is Imam Ali alayhi salam, to stay silent in such an issue. But anyhow, Shaykh, Lady Fatima at that time was not alive. Even if Imam alayhi salam wanted to take it back, Lady Fatima was not alive. What was good of it? Because can we say that it was going to be inherited to her sons?
Maybe we can talk about the inheritance of the, you know, sons of Lady Fatima. Or, of course, politically speaking, it has a lot of message.
Yeah.
When you take back the Fadak, it means that the action and the practice of Caliph before Imam Ali was a mistake, actually. Mm-hmm. It has some political message behind that. But, as I said, generally speaking, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam did not have sufficient time for doing that, mm-hmm. because he engaged in at least three wars against the different, you know, people mm-hmm. and communities, and it was necessary for the Islamic Ummah to safeguard the Islamic Ummah, and it was a very limited time for Imam Ali, and he couldn't find enough time to practice the for the benefit of the Islamic Ummah. But as I said, the main answer in that is that because from the perspective of people, it has been looked upon to be a family right or the personal right of that, and they were away from doing such actions.
And it has two messages. One, that the caliphs of the time actually violated the right of a mu'min, a believer. So they cannot be right caliphs right after the Prophet. This is something that needs to be scrutinized and studied well to see that. How can a caliph of the time in an Islamic Ummah violate the right of a person, and the person actually cannot even take her right back? Second, the prophets have this right to gift something to their children, to their sons and grandsons. So this right has been legitimated in Quran, and it has been, as you said, وَوَرَثَ سُلَيْمَانُ دَاوُودُ. So these two messages are, I think, important messages that we can take from this lesson.
Yes, you're right. Talking about first part of your point that you mentioned, I would like to add to that, it is not only the practice of the caliphs. We have some, scholarly criticize to some of their actions. You see, of course, this is the history. Look at some of the innovations of the second caliph with regard to the prayer, with regard to the divorce and the marriage, and so on and so forth. It has been mentioned, it has been mentioned in the history books about the
Mut'at al-Hajj.
Yes, some of the innovations of the second caliphs in that regard. But of course, they justify that whether they are forgiven because they were in the beginning of Islam, or whether they are bid'ah hasana, which means the nice innovation. But anyway, according to Shia scholars, we have only one innovation which is forbidden, and we do not have other such innovations.
Many thanks, dear Sheikh, for your scholarly enlightenment, and you respected listeners for your staying tuned and listening to Q&A Islamic Beliefs. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن علي وحسين وحسن.
يوسف جلالي تهران
روباشافيت غازا
جيروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir. the reporters.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defence ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe cost in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, you know, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, so protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. but North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the U.S. and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the U.S. and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioners stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which I mean, a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue. Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence. Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdullahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
A If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp and excessive cold anyway, with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're just going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipur is up, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range of conditions, vaccine hesitancy and skepticism. Is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage. To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what's in it. They say they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. They call me when I had it. I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. And people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now. You see? A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something, I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump's rally in Arizona on Saturday, 15th of January, featured a host of election deniers. His involvement in state races and his inability to let go of his 2020 election loss worries many Republicans. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled "Trump Rally Underscores GOP Tension Over How to Win in 2022. Former President Donald Trump returned on Saturday, 15th of January, to Arizona, a cradle of his political movement, to headline a rally in the desert that was a striking testament to how he has elevated fringe beliefs and the politicians who spread them, even as other Republicans openly worry that voters will ultimately punish their party for it. Donald Trump's favorite candidate for governor, Kerry Lake, is a first-time office seeker who has threatened to jail the state's top election official. His chosen candidate to replace that election official, a Democrat, is a state legislator named Mark Fincham, who was with a group of demonstrators outside the Capitol on 6th of January as rioters tried to stop the certification of the 2020 election. And one of his most unflinching defenders in Congress is Representative Paul Gosar, who was censured by his colleagues for posting an animated video online that depicted him killing a Democratic congresswoman and assaulting President Joe Biden. All three spoke at Donald Trump's rally in front of thousands of supporters on Saturday in the town of Florence, just outside Phoenix, Arizona. It was the first stadium-style political event he has held so far in his midterm election year, in which he will try to deepen his imprint on Republicans running for office at all levels. When Donald Trump took the stage in the evening, he lavished praise on the slate of election denier candidates in attendance, and he suggested that perpetuating his grievances about being cheated would be a decisive issue for Republican candidates. "We can't let them get away with it," Donald Trump said. Then he added, referring to Ms. Lake and her rejection of the 2020 election results, "I think it's one of the reasons she is doing so well." But as popular as the former president remains with the core of the GOP's base, his involvement in races from Arizona to Pennsylvania and his inability to let go of his election loss to Joe Biden has veteran Republicans in Washington and beyond concerned. They worry that Donald Trump is imperiling their chances in what should be a highly advantageous political climate, with Democrats deeply divided over their policy agenda and Americans taking a generally pessimistic view of Joe Biden's leadership a year into his presidency. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, and other senior party officials have expressed their misgivings in recent days about Donald Trump's fixation on the last election, saying that it threatens to alienate the voters that they need to win over in the next election this November. Those worries are particularly acute in Arizona, where the far-right Trump-endorsed candidates could prove too extreme in a state that moved Democratic in the last election, as voters came out in large numbers to oppose Donald Trump. The myth of widespread voter fraud is animating Arizona campaigns in several races, alarming Republicans who argue that indulging the former president's misrepresentations and falsehoods about 2020 is jeopardizing the party's long-term competitiveness. "I've never seen so many Republicans running in a primary for governor, attorney general, and Senate," said Chuck Conklin, a Republican consultant who has worked on statewide races in Arizona for two decades. "Usually you get two, or maybe three, but not five." At the rally on Saturday, every speaker who took the stage before Donald Trump repeated a version of the false assertion that the vote in Arizona in 2020 was fraudulent. Paul Gosar, the congressman, did so in perhaps the darkest language, invoking the image of a building storm, a metaphor commonly used by followers of the QAnon conspiracy theory, and he called for people involved in counting ballots in Arizona in 2020 to be imprisoned. "Lock them up," Paul Gosar told the crowd. "That election was rotten to the core." For Republicans who are concerned about Donald Trump's influence on candidates they believe are unelectable, the basic math of such crowded primaries is difficult to stomach. A winner could prevail with just a third of the total vote, which makes it more than likely a far-right candidate who is unpalatable to the broader electorate can win the nomination largely on Donald Trump's endorsement. Conservative activists in Arizona have long supplied Mr. Trump with the energy and ideas that formed the foundation of his political movement. In 2011, when the real estate developer and reality television star was testing the waters for a possible presidential campaign, his interest in the conspiracy theories that claimed former President Barack Obama's birth certificate was a forgery led him to Arizona Tea Party activists and a state legislator. They were pushing for a state law to require that political candidates produce their birth certificates before qualifying for the ballot. Donald Trump invited them to Trump Tower in New York. One of those activists, Kelly Townsend, now a state senator, spoke to the crowd on Saturday and praised those who sought to delegitimize Joe Biden's win. Arizona has been a hotbed of distortions about the 2020 election. Allies of the former president demanded an audit in the state's largest county, insisting that the official outcome had been compromised by fraud. But when the results of the review were released in a report both commissioned and produced by Trump's supporters, it ended up showing that he actually received 261 fewer votes than first thought. Still, the myth lives on, and those who question it quickly become targets of the former president and his allies. They have attacked two prominent Arizona Republicans, Governor Doug Ducey and Attorney General Mark Brnovich, for their roles in Arizona's former certification of its election results. "He's never going to get my endorsement, I can tell you that," Donald Trump said of Mr. Ducey. Even those who have resisted going along with Donald Trump's false claims have been unable to completely duck the issue when faced with pressure from the president and his supporters. When a group of 18 Republican attorneys general signed onto a far-fetched lawsuit from their counterpart in Texas that sought to delay the certification of the vote in four battleground states that Donald Trump lost, Mr. Brnovich did not join his colleagues. He declared at the time that the rule of law should prevail over politics. But as a candidate for Senate, who still occupies the office of the Attorney General, he has investigated claims of fraud at the behest of Trump supporters. As speaker after speaker attacked the credibility of the vote on Saturday, those with Donald Trump's official imprimatur were announced as Trump-endorsed. Several also called on the state legislature to retroactively vote to overturn Joe Biden's win. Donald Trump's allies said they expect the issue to take on more urgency in the coming weeks, even though it would have no legal or practical impact. "Arizona is a red state," said State Senator Wendy Rogers, leading the crowd on a decertified chant. "We are not turning purple."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله brothers and sisters, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen and other life forms. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab and in the studio I'm joined by my amazing co-host
Asma Ansari. I'm very glad to be here.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to have you with us. All right, so today I thought we would try to tackle the question that how can I love myself?
That's the question.
That's the question. But I feel that in order to answer this question, we must create the sort of preface for it. And the combination of the answers
yes.
would bring us to a coherent, comprehensive, and more intelligent answer
of
for
course.
Our main,
yes.
right?
We have to have a map.
I think the key words that we need to define here is one, what is loving
myself?
What does it look like? How does it manifest? Loving myself. Who is this myself that I'm speaking of?
Yes.
Right? And what objective am I trying to reach?
By loving myself.
By loving myself. We all understand the merits, the values, the virtues of loving others.
Yes.
Of being selfless, of being helpful, of being compassionate, of being sympathetic. Whether you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist or an atheist.
Human being.
Whether you're whatever.
Yes, whatever.
You are, these are values,
yes.
Right? Caring for other people, being helpful, being compassionate, being sympathetic, being kind,
yes.
Being just. They're values since the beginning of time. There's
exactly.
No one who can argue with that. And we know the results of loving others.
Yes.
Right? You
mm-hmm.
know, we know the effects. We know the fruits it will bear and its importance. Everyone gets that. Everyone understands it. But then I love myself, and then what?
Well, I think if we define it this way, that loving myself manifests itself by loving others, it makes more sense.
Please elaborate.
Yes, I have to. Well, when I love myself, and it is only for the sake of whatever I have. For example, I'm a kind person, so I love myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a responsible person, so I love myself. Well, one day, 2 day, 1 month, 2 months, you're going to be done with it. But when you show it through loving others and through caring about the society you're living in, that's going to be a permanent sort of loving.
Seriously?
Yes.
That's how you feel about it? That is such
yes.
an interesting view, because I feel the exact opposite. And I just love it when we, looking at the world through other person's lenses, giving
yes.
us new perspective. Because I feel like if I love other people,
yes.
that's going to be 1 day, 2 day, 2 months, 3 years, right? Because people aren't a constant, stable
no,
part of my life.
No, the effects will remain with you. I mean, when you help someone who is distressed and who's having a problem, when you help them, when you hear to them, it's the kind of feeling they give it to you. I mean,
the energy.
The reflection of what they're feeling would come to you in a way that it would give you a sort of satisfaction that will remain with you. Then, in times, once in a time, when you're alone and you're so helpless and you're sad, you think of that time and you say, that was a nice experience. I'm not this bad that I'm thinking.
Mm.
I have some merits as well.
Mm.
I'm not as bad
contribute.
As I think I am.
Right.
I have some good things in me.
Mm.
Deep down, I'm a good human being. I'm kind. I am responsible. I can make people happy.
I invite you to listen to the continuation of the program on IRIB English Radio.
But here's the thing. I totally get what you're saying, and I feel that it is definitely something that makes life worthwhile.
Yes.
Contributing to another human being's life and
yes.
changing it for the better, even if it's one person, even if it's for one moment.
Exactly.
Right? And it ripples.
Yes.
It ripples in that person's life. It ripples in my life. It ripples in the universe
exactly.
as a whole. But I think the reason why nowadays people are inclining more toward loving themselves rather than others is that, number one, they do not want to define their own value based on what they can do for other people.
Their own existence is for their own self.
Yes. That's number one. Number two is because other people are inconsistent. They're not a stable, consistent, continuous part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
If I constantly rip my heart into pieces and place it in different people during different times,
yes.
at some point I will suffer burnout.
and I will feel like, well, there's absolutely nothing left for me.
No, I mean the worthy ones in your life.
I'm just trying to think of this
yes,
from
I know
the,
what
their,
you're
their,
saying.
Their viewpoint, their
yes,
place
different,
of mind.
Different right? glasses on my
yeah,
eyes.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like people are now trying to train themselves to love themselves more because they feel like when things get rough, I am here for me.
You mean they've come to a point at life
yes.
where they know the truth, that
yes.
there is no one here for you.
And
you're alone.
I'm, yes.
You're a lonesome traveler.
And to an extent, I low-key agree with that. I feel that the mentality, this mind, especially toward women.
Yes, women.
It's women's sole jobs to have unconditional love
settlers.
For others. Exactly. Mm. It's women's sole job to give love,
yes.
to give compassion, to take care of others. And often, she will end up pouring from an empty cup.
Being taken for granted.
Exactly. And turned into a doormat. She's constantly giving. She ain't receiving from others.
Yeah.
And she's not recharging herself.
Exactly.
Right?
There's no refreshment.
I see a lot of fathers, older brothers that do this too.
Yes, yes. Because they're so protective and so
exactly.
caring.
Exactly. And they're the maintainers and they're the guardians. I feel like, yeah, sometimes you kind of got to tell yourself that, well, you can go ahead and take care of yourself, random person. By random, I don't mean actual random, but like A, B, and C
yes,
person.
Yes.
Mom, dad, sister, uncle, spouse, child, cousin,
yes.
neighbor. Go take care of yourself because you ain't taking care of me. Someone's got to do that for me too.
So now tell me, you're living alone in this world.
Yes, I am.
How would you love yourself? There's no one to reflect to you that you are a good person.
Mm-hmm.
You're
mm-hmm.
a loving person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How would it end?
Personally, from personal experience,
yes.
I feel loving myself has manifested, has been displayed in my life as being kinder to me, using kinder words with myself. Because we do that a lot.
And are you successful?
I've been more successful in doing it. And while... after doing it, I've become more successful in stuff, you know, in a more general aspect of my life. Using kinder words.
Yeah.
Being more tolerant with myself. We're so kind toward other people.
And do you think it would lead to selfishness?
A little selfishness is fine, I think.
Just a little?
Yes.
And
actually,
how would you understand the borders?
I'd rather call it boundaries. If you call it boundaries rather than selfishness, it will have a more positive connotation for you.
They're
for
important.
You to be able to put your foot down and tell the other person in kind, respectful terms that is not okay with me, back off.
Yes, that's very true.
Mm. I cannot answer this need of yours, back off. Or go ask someone else or fulfill it yourself.
Yes.
Even to our children. When they are 3 months old and they have like baby stomach aches syndrome thing, and no matter how tired you are and how depleted you are, you have to cater to that baby's need.
Yes.
Even if you don't do it directly, call your mom, call a nurse, call your sister, call whatever
yes, yes.
to cater to that baby's needs. But when a child is already a grown adult,
yes.
with life experience, responsibility, and their own, you
at
know.
Different ages, different behaviors.
You
we teach them to be kind with others, but also we teach them to be kind to themselves, not always torturing themselves.
Yes, and not always torturing us.
Yes.
And that is one way of self-love.
Okay, everyone who's been listening to us, stay tuned. We're going to have a break, and then we'll catch up together. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Listen. listeners of Youth Station. We're back and we're going to follow the discussion.
Maybe self-love is, it's turned into such a cliche, overused, overrated
nowadays,
word.
But nowadays, just interrupting you, but sure. Just came into my mind. Nowadays, being kind to yourself means being selfish. I mean, if you go through the media, you see that people use that word interchangeably. They do not know and they do not call it selfishness, but what they actually are feeling and doing is called selfishness and not love of myself, love for myself, being kind to myself. That's more of selfishness.
Yeah, in some cases.
That's why I'm just saying that we have to know, the according to what you said, the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
That's a better word to
definitely
put.
Definitely.
Boundaries are much better.
Yes.
Loving yourself has an extreme.
Uh-huh.
More than that extreme, you shouldn't put your foot, because that's going to be dangerous.
For sure. Absolutely.
To others and to you.
And perhaps maybe this is another reason why we need to redefine it. And because the term self-love has become so overrated and cliche,
exactly,
it's a better idea to use a different term.
Exactly.
Like, I personally really favor self-respect.
Yes, self-respect is better.
Integrity.
I favor that too.
Dignity. I respect myself.
Dignity.
Right?
Dignity is very important.
Yes. I think that I am worthy.
Yes.
Of so-and-so treatment.
Yes.
And I do not deserve so-and-so treatment. I
yes.
respect myself too much.
That's
I am
it.
Better than this.
Yes.
I am better. And especially for women out there, you are better than having
you
to
deserve more.
Eat your children's leftovers,
yes.
wearing torn, stained clothes.
Yes. For the sake of your children.
Yes, for the sake of your children. Not taking care of yourself, your skin, your hair, your body
yes,
for long
too bad.
Periods of months. Because, oh, I just don't have time. Oh, because the kids need
yes.
me. Oh, because...
my priority is my kids'
yes,
priority.
No. Your
their
priority
need.
Is always yourself,
yes,
your
exactly.
growth. And our children are not our objective. Our spouse, they're not,
yes,
he's not our objective.
Yes, yes.
He's just that Allah has placed in my life for me to be able to attain self-growth.
Yes.
And if we look at it like that, then everything circulates about around
to nurture a worthy person like you. So you
yes.
have to be worthy to teach your children
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Thank you so very much for being with us. I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior. My giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com
www.irib.org/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.